Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Religious Zionism, what it means and why it matters. We have a very loaded, charged topic today, and that is the halachic status of Gentiles in modern day Israel. And let me sort of portray it as follows. One of the charges of religious Zionism is the ability to sort of merge philosophy and idealism with the real practical world. This is something we studied extensively, right? We can have all the idealism in the world about going to Israel, establishing a state there, and building up the place. And then when it comes to actualizing that in the real world, things get complicated. And Zionism is very much about the practical and the real. One of the prominent themes of Zionism is that we don't simply wait for God to bring redemption, but we do something about it. And so today, we're going to study a difficult topic in many different ways. Difficult in terms of the way it makes us feel, and difficult in terms of the actual reality on the ground and dealing with the situation in Israel, which is obviously not a simple one. And part of the mission is going to be how we merge the halacha, the Jewish law and tradition, and traditional Jewish sources with the reality on the ground in a state of Israel, which is on the one hand a Jewish state, but is on the other hand a democratic state. That's what the goal of the state is to be, and where there are so many viewpoints and so many people of different stripes and colors. So let's begin by introducing the problem. I'm just going to share my screen in case it becomes on a bit late. And you should be able to see my source sheet right about now. And here we go. The problem, I think, can be described pretty simply. Because we have, on the one hand, Israel's Declaration of Independence. And on the other hand, what the halacha says about these topics. So in source number one, I have for you that this is an excerpt from Israel's Declaration of Independence as translated by the Knesset. This is as official a source as you can get. And it's a very inspiring excerpt. And this states as follows. The state of Israel will be open for Jewish immigration and for the ingathering of the exiles. It will foster the development of the country for the benefit of all its inhabitants. It will be based on freedom, justice, and peace as envisaged by the prophets of Israel. It will ensure a complete equality of social and political rights to all its inhabitants, and here are some of the key words, irrespective of religion, race, or sex. It will guarantee freedom of religion, conscience, language, education, and culture. It will safeguard the holy places of all religions, and it will be faithful to the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. So reads Israel's Declaration of Independence. And I just find that I just have to say very inspiring that the Declaration of Independence of a modern state would include it references to the ingathering of the exiles, references to the vision of the prophets of Israel. That's certainly very inspiring. But looking at this and on a first level, are you comfortable or uncomfortable with this state excerpt from Israel's Declaration of Independence? You read this and say, yeah, that's what I believe in, or does something sort of rub you the wrong way? If I were to ask you, what do you think? Looking at this Declaration of Independence, something that, you know, reading it, it's, are we comfortable with it, uncomfortable with it?
Well, the first sentence has a contradiction, the benefit of all its inhabitants. But before we get there, there are special rights for Jews.
Okay, that's a certainly interesting point. I'm not sure that's a contradiction per se, but I hear what you're saying. It's open there, so that's part of the balance that we'll have to deal with, right? That there are certain even within the state itself, there are certain unique rights for Jewish people, but it's for the benefit of all of its inhabitants. And how do you balance that? Certainly a legitimate point. What do we think about the fact that it's based on freedom, justice, and peace, and it will ensure a complete equality of social and political rights to all its inhabitants? Pro or against? That's a simple question. We like that or not?
Well, how else would you put it? I mean, it's got to be for all inhabitants. I mean,
sounds good to me, right? It's those of us who live in democratic countries certainly can relate to such a formulation. It resonates with us. We are raised to believe in a certain tolerance and freedom of religion and not imposing our will upon other people. And that reality has been crucial for the Jewish people throughout the diaspora. We've gone to many places where we did not have these rights, and it worked against us, not in our favor. So for Israel to enshrine this in its Declaration of Independence, on the one hand, is certainly something we would be comfortable with, just based on our own modern sensibilities. That being said, the question that arises, as you know, religious Zionists, we have to ask, what does the Torah say about freedom of religion or religious tolerance or complete equality of social and political rights to all Israel's inhabitants, irrespective of religion, race, or sex? And the answer, of course, is it's complicated, quite complicated. Let me raise, just for now, two different psukim verses and commandments from the Torah, which seem to counter this vision as outlined in the Declaration of Independence. Verse number 2, I have an excerpt from Shemot, chapter 23. And here, God speaks to the children of Israel as he instructs them about their future entry into the land of Israel. And he writes, Lo techrot lahem ve'elohehem beres. You shall not forge a covenant with them or their gods, them being the nations that currently inhabit the land of Israel, the seven Canaanite nations. And there is the key line, which we're going to have to grapple with tonight. Lo yeshivu be'artzecha, pen yachatiu otecha li. They, quote unquote, and here it, in context, specifically refers to the inhabitants of Israel at the time, they shall not remain in your land, lest they cause you to sin against me. Ki tavod et Eloheihem, for you will serve their gods. Ki yihyeh lecha lemokesh, and it will prove a snare to you. So the Torah tells us, lo yeshivu ba'artzecha, these idolatrous nations shall not dwell in your land. Now, just an interesting note, Ravaggio Sforno, 16th century Italian commentator, makes the following comment. Lo yeshavu ba'artzecha ba'oto achelek me'aretz shetichvos, whichever section of the land that you conquer, v'teyeshevo, and that you inhabit, ata lo yeshuhem, they shall not dwell. They should not dwell in those parts of Israel that you conquer. And he says this didn't actually happen historically. When the Jews conquered Israel and began settling the land of Israel, they actually did not make sure that they were not among idolaters. Rather, they did live among them and they were influenced negatively. And he says, Ki yel l'chol mokesh, shiftam ba'artzecha. Their residence in your land will be a snare, a stumbling block for you. Sheyigrom shetavod et Elohim. It will cause that you shall serve their idols. We're worried about assimilation and negative influences. Furthermore, that is going to be the primary focus tonight, that notion of lo yeshu ba'artzecha. Again, the notion that there is a prohibition against allowing certain idolatrous nations to live in the land of Israel. Source number 4 presents another challenge in dealing with the Israeli Declaration of Independence. And this is pretty clear, right? Says Ribono Shalom, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Bnei Yisrael in Devarim chapter 12, Abdeid to Abedun, so these are the laws and statutes which you shall observe to do. Ba'aret, in the land, that Hashem, your God, is giving to you to inherit it. Call Yamim Asher Temachem Aldema, for all the days that you are in the land. Abed to Abdunah, call Mekomor Asher Adu Shamha Goyim. You shall destroy and eradicate all of the places which the nations serve there. Asher Dortem Roshim Otam. At Elohim, where they serve their gods, the ones that you are conquering. They serve these idols on the mount, on the high mountains, on the valleys, and under every tree. You shall smash their altar. You shall destroy and break their monuments. And you shall burn their trees. And you shall destroy and cut down their idols. You shall eradicate their name from that place. And the Rambam here passes in source number 5 that generally we are enjoined to eradicate idolatry, but specifically in the land of Israel, we have a proactive obligation to seek out idolatry and destroy it according to the Torah. Says the Rambam in source number 5, there is a positive commandment to eradicate all idolatry and the things used to serve idolatry and everything made for it. We have various sukkim instructing us to do this. But in the land of Israel, so taking a step back, that would mean that if we came across idolatry, then we have to do something to destroy it. So this actually has halachic ramifications. If a person buys a house and they find some sort of idol in that house, there is an obligation to do something to destroy that idol, to ruin it. But that's if you come across the idol. In Israel, it's more than that. Be'eretz Yisrael mitzvah l'rdof achareha ad sh'na'abed otam mikol artzeinu. In the land of Israel, there is an obligation to pursue it until we eradicate it from our entire land. Aval b'chutz la'aretz einonu mitzvah l'rdof achareha l'kol makom sh'nikvo sh'otam na'abed kol v'lo kachavim shabo. Outside the land, we have no obligation to pursue the idols. Rather, if we conquer a place, then we should rid it of idolatry.
I ask something?
Yes, you can.
Okay, I wouldn't mind getting rid of some of the fifth columns that are around in Israel right now, but do we regard, I don't think we regard either Islam or Christianity as Avodah Zarah.
Okay, excellent question. We're going to get to this, right? So one question to ask is, what does the current status of the people who live in Israel who are not Jewish? And Yonah mentions is Muslims and Christians. Do they fall under the category of these prohibitions? That is an excellent question, which we will address. And guess what? You know what the answer is? It's complicated. Very complicated. But how do we feel, though, about the... Yes, yes. That's Charlie? Go for it, Charlie.
So far, I don't see a very good argument so far.
Argument for what?
Because the wording here about idolatry and all that, it seems to still be connected to the people at the time that Joshua crossed the Jordan.
Good.
And there are much stronger words that could be said in the Torah if you wanted to include future eras.
Right.
For example, say Amalek.
Right.
There's stronger words there. And don't forget or whatever. There could have been a stronger words in the Torah saying Ad Olam or something like that. Those words.
100%. So we'll have to see about that, Charlie. Let's hold that for now. The question is that Charlie is raising is a very important question, which is, do these prohibitions apply to anyone other than the nations that inhabited the land of Canaan at the time that Joshua conquered the land? And that is an argument. That is a dispute. Whether that this extends to all sort of idolaters or specifically those who existed at the time when the Jewish people entered the land of Israel. Fair. And the reason it would specifically apply to those is because the Torah in numerous places speaks at length about how grotesque and ugly and horrible the behavior of those nations was. And therefore, one could argue that these prohibitions are specifically geared toward those peoples. We have some prohibitions that only apply to those nations. So it wouldn't be crazy. Before I take another question, I want to take one. I just want to discuss for a second the following. Why? If you ask the question, why do we have to get rid of all this stuff, specifically in the land of Israel? Why do we have to go about making sure that there are no idolaters there? Is it because we hate these people? We don't like them? So you could think about this and consider it, but I don't think it's that unheard of in terms of at least the mission that is forming a people in the land of Israel. It's not just that we want to live there. We have a mission and a goal in living there. And here, Rabbi Elazar Melamed, who we're going to hear from a lot tonight, please God, actually writes very beautifully about this in source number 6. Rabbi Elazar Melamed is a prominent posek and rabbi today in the land of Israel who addresses many of these topics. And he writes as follows. The great vision of the people of Israel in their land is that the land will be settled by the people of Israel. And on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, there will be a temple. All the systems of national life shall be directed based on the ways of Torah in its morality and sanctity. Israel will be a light unto the nations that will come to visit the land, where they will receive instruction as to how to fix the nations and the world. And he quotes Isaiah in chapter 2, verse 2 to 4. And this is actually a Chabad.org's translation, where Isaiah says, and it shall be at the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be firmly established atop the mountains. And it shall be raised above the hills, and all the nations shall stream to it. It's not that we don't have any sort of universal vision. It's not that we only care about ourselves. No. We want to have an influence on the nations of the world. And many people shall go, and they shall say, come, let us go up to the Lord's mount, to the house of God of Jacob, and let him teach us of his ways, and we will go in his paths. For out of Zion shall the Torah come forth, of course. Ki mitzion teitzei Torah. And the words of the Lord from Jerusalem, all, and he shall judge between the nations and reprove many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift the sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Right? Famous token from Messiah. The vision is that there should be no more war, that there should be peace, and the nation will be directed. The world will be directed based on the ways and morality of the Torah. However, says Rav Elazar Melamed, how do we get to that point? Says Rav Melamed, I'll tell you how. Kedei l'hagshim adachazon, in order to actualize his vision, sarish ha'aretz kula, t'yimushev ha'idei Yisrael, v'rakayim shechafetzim liot shutfim l'chazon ha'gadol sh'Yisrael. The only way to accomplish this, he argues, is that the land shall be settled by the Jews and only Gentiles who desire to be partners with the Jews in this vision. They can join the Jewish people in the status of ger toshav, a resident, which we'll have to define. We have a long way to implementing this vision. We have to figure out how to, as best as we can, fulfill it. So that being said, you understand the problem. The problem is we have this vision, we have the laws of the Torah, and they don't seem to fit very nicely, Charlie's point aside, they don't seem to fit so nicely with, the line, the Declaration of Independence. And while I will say that I am very comfortable with the notion of religious freedom naturally in terms of how I was raised, that I do understand where Rabbi Malamud is coming from, that in a world with religious pluralism or pluralism generally, where everything goes and no vision is sort of emphasized above any other, then it's very hard to accomplish his vision. There's no sort of clear truth, no sort of clear path. Everybody does what they want. It's hard to accomplish that this way. So how do we reconcile is the question. How do we reconcile halacha, or can we reconcile halacha with the Israeli Declaration of Independence? That is the question we need to address. Understand? You understand the question? I think it's pretty clear and certainly bothersome. Not easy, not an easy topic whatsoever. So I would like to present a few different avenues. We're not going to solve all the problems of the state of Israel and religion today. I hope I won't disappoint you by saying that. But we can at least formulate a few different approaches as to how to think about the issues. The first important topic to consider is that of Ger Toshav. A Ger Toshav, you could call a legitimate resident, is a Gentile who is not Jewish, who has certain rights in halacha beyond those of a non-ger toshav, a ordinary Gentile. And specifically, it is a person who has the right where he or she can live among the Jewish people in Israel. That this notion of lo yeshavu ba'artzecha, this prohibition against allowing them, quote-unquote, to live in the land of Israel, certainly does not apply to a ger toshav. So the question is going to be then as follows. Number one, we have to define the scope of who it is we are and are not halachically allowed to let live in the land of Israel. And this is for the first topic. And number two, determine how do we define ger toshav? What does a person have to do for them to become not just a Gentile, but a ger toshav? So the Gemara in Gittin clarifies this, that this does not apply to everyone. Says the Gemara in Gittin, when it says, lo yeshu ba'artzecha, you might have thought that this even refers to someone who accepts upon themselves not to serve idolatry. Talmud Lomar, lo tasgir eved el adonav, asher yinatzel elecha me'im adonav. No, that cannot be. How do we know that? Because we have a prohibition as follows, without getting into the details here. There's a prohibition in the Torah. If you have a servant, a slave, who runs away from their master to the land of Israel, you are not allowed to return that slave back to their master. Rather, you have to ensure that they remain with you. And the Gemara says, Ma'atakanto, imcha yeshev bekir becha. The way, what should you do instead? They shall dwell in your midst. What you see from this, the Gemara infers, is that if we are allowing this servant to live among us, it must be that since he has accepted upon himself not to worship idolatry, what the Torah is telling us is you cannot return him to his idolatrous or her idolatrous master. And that acceptance not to serve idolatry is sufficient to allow him or her to live in the land of Israel. So that is one Gemara. That sounds pretty broad in terms of allowance. Just one category. However, it is possible that this is subject to a different dispute, because we, in the Gemara in source number 8 in Avodah Zarah, we have three different opinions as to what it takes for a Gentile to become a ger toshav, a legitimate resident. Says the Gemara in source number 8, Avodah Zarah 64b, Ezehu ger toshav. Who is a ger toshav? Kol shekibel alav bifnei gimel chavirim shelo la'avod avodah kachavim. So we notice two things here. Number one, there's the process. You don't just snap your fingers and become a ger toshav. There is a formal process of sort of adjudicating who becomes a Garatosha and who does not. It's almost a quasi-conversion. So the first opinion is it's a person who comes in front of three Jewish people and declares that they will no longer serve idolatry. That is a Garatosha. Rabbi Meir. That is Rabbi Meir's opinion. Bachacham Momrim Kol Shekibel Alav Sheva Mitzvot Shekiblu Alehem B'nei Noach. No. Idolatry is insufficient. It is not enough to simply commit to not serving idolatry. Rather, it is anybody who accepts upon themselves that they will keep the seven Noahide laws. Now, what's interesting about this is, again, there's a formality here. We believe that all non-Jews are obligated to keep the seven Noahide laws, whether they accept it upon themselves or not. We do not see this as optional. But to be conferred the status of Gerut Toshav, you need to declare that you're going to do it, to commit to it in front of sort of a Jewish court, so that it becomes not just, okay, we assume that you're going to do it, because how do we know that you're actually going to do it? But rather that there is that formal commitment and assurance that you're going to. That's the second opinion. And finally, you have the most stringent opinion. Achirim omrim, elu lo bo lechlal Gerut Toshav. Others say that these people have not become Geri Toshavim, these legitimate residents. Ela Ezu Ger Toshav, Zeger Ochel Nevelot, Shalah, Kivel Allah, Kayim, Kol Mitzvot Amuro, Batora, Chutzme, Isor Nevelot. To become a Ger Toshav, you have to keep every single mitzvah except for that of eating non kosher food. We got to do all the mitzvot, everything else. Just quite a stringent opinion. So we have three opinions here as to what constitutes a Gerut Toshav. And I'll add another question, and we're not going to totally explore this topic, but how do you reconcile sources 7 and 8? You could separate them. You could suggest that 7 is not talking about a Gerut Toshav. In order to live in Israel, all you need to do is simply say, I am not going to serve Avodah Zarah. I don't serve idolatry. You don't even need that status. However, you could argue that the Gemara in Gittin 45a is in accordance with the first opinion of Rav Meir. That's why it says you only require an acceptance of not serving idolatry. But according to the Chachamim, the sages, you would need to accept upon oneself all seven Noahide laws. But we have these three Rabbi, different opinions here.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I don't think there is a law in the seven Noahide laws regarding idolatry, is there?
Of course there is.
Which
we'll get
one?
To that in just a second.
Which one is it?
Okay, so what are the seven Noahide? Let's go through the seven idolatry laws. Actually, I'll skip down here. I have a little list over here. I'll highlight it. See, what are the seven laws? Existence of God, idolatry, murder, incest, flesh of a live animal, robbery, and right of property. Right of property is a bit imprecise. That actually refers to dinim, adjudication, that there is an obligation upon Gentiles to establish courts, at least according to the way the Rabban understands it, to make sure that these other laws and that generally that society is in order, that they need to prosecute people for breaking the law and murdering and stealing.
So
that's what it means by right of property. Yeah. Exactly.
So how do you define number two? How do you define idolatry?
Okay, good question. Good question. It's obviously a lot to get into, but good question. That being said, if you look at the Rambam in source number 9, as you may have guessed, the Rambam understands that a Ger Toshav is somebody who accepts the Noahide laws. Taking a look briefly here at source number 9 in the Rambam. The Rambam, number 1, quotes a number of different laws in the Gemara about Darchei Shalom, that even with full-fledged idolaters, the Talmud says in various places, there are many measures of sort of goodwill that we extend to idolaters to keep the peace, in order to promote ways of peace. So we can greet them, we let them gather the leftover produce from the field, and we sustain them, we give them charity. However, that's all what the Rambam calls Darchei Shalom, to keep the peace. And then he qualifies. Ein kol dvarim ha'elu amurim Ella bizman shagalu Yisrael ve'nevin odei kochavim. And this is all said in the following two circumstances, where we try to extend these measures of peace to full-fledged idolaters. It's said when the Jews are in exile, and we'll have to get back to this phrase, shayad akum takifa Yisrael, when the hand of the idolaters is dominant on Israel. We do not have sovereignty or control. Aval bizman shayad Yisrael takifa alehem, when the hand of Israel is dominant upon them, we do have that control. Asur lanu lahaniach ovdei kochavim b'ineinu. We cannot allow idolaters to live among us. V'alfil yoshev yeshivat arayu ovim emakum emakum b'schora lo yavor b'yaseinu ad sheyekal bel alav sheva mitzvot shitstavu b'nei Noah. We cannot allow an idolater to even pass through in our land until they accept upon themselves the seven Noahide laws. So let's stop there. Imki belashem mitzvot harezeger tosha. If they do accept the seven Noahide laws, then they are a ger toshav, and then they can live in Israel. So, stopping here for a second, does Judaism allow for religious freedom? The answer is it's complicated. On the one hand, we do not compel people to be Jewish. We don't compel people to keep all 613 mitzvot. We don't compel people to convert. At the same time, it's not a free-for-all. There's seven Noahide laws that we do expect people to keep, and especially in the land of Israel, right? So it's not you can do whatever you want. It's not full freedom of religion. It's you can't worship idols. You can't steal. You can't kill. You can't commit incest. Right, all these things are not acceptable according to Torah law in the land of Israel. As if it wasn't complicated enough, the Rambam adds the following line, which causes great controversy. Says the Rambam, it's based on a Tal Gemara in Irchin. The ain mekablin ger toshav ela bizman shehayovel nohe. We only accept the formal status of conversion to a ger toshav, a legitimate resident, in a time when the jubilee year, the yovel year, is operative. Aval bizman shelo bizman hayovel, but when the jubilee year, if you're familiar with the Shemitah cycle, every seventh year is the sabbatical year. Every seven sabbatical years, the next year is the 50th year, the yovel year. There are certain laws associated with the yovel year. And that only is operative under certain conditions, when most of the Jewish people are in the land of Israel and we have a temple, and et cetera. Actually, you don't need a temple, but there are certain conditions for the Jubilee year to be operative. It's not operative nowadays. And the Gemara says, and I'm not 100% sure why this is so, it seems to be sort of just a rule that you can only accept a formal ger toshav when it's the Yovel year is operative, meaning we can no longer accept a formal ger toshav. So that would be pretty problematic, wouldn't it? That even if someone said, I'm going to keep all seven Noahide laws, they can't become a ger toshav. What does that mean in terms of allowing them to live in the land? This is a subject of dispute in two ways. Number one, it's a subject of dispute as to whether or not the Rambam is correct in saying this. And number two, there's a dispute as to what the Rambam really meant. The Ravid of Avram ibn David, the contemporary of the Rambam who lived in Provence at the time when the Rambam was written, has a line that he sees an argument on this Rambam, where he writes, you look at source number 10, I quote the beginning, Rabbi Avram Ibn David explains that although a derish toshav can't be formally accepted in today's age when the Yovel year isn't operative, if a person accepts the seven Noahide laws, why should we prevent them from living in the land? There is no need to worry that they will bring about sin. Says the Ravid, maybe you're right, Rambam. There's a certain formal status of ger toshav that we can no longer confer upon people because we lack the necessary requirements to do so. But there's a more pragmatic concern here. the concern of allowing people to live in Israel is when they don't keep the seven Noahai laws practically, because we are afraid of the negative influences that they will have on other inhabitants of the land. So says Rav Avraham ibn Aviv, Rambam, you maybe you're right, but that's not relevant to whether or not we can allow such people to live in the land of Israel. Even if we can't formally confer this status upon them, as long as we can be assured that they're going to keep the seven Noahai laws, that should be sufficient. So that's the first point in this Rambam. Is the Rambam correct in saying that now that we can no longer confer the status of Ger Toshav, does that mean we can't accept people who want to keep the seven Noahai laws but haven't attained that formal status? Furthermore, Rav Yosef Karo, author of the Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch, and commentator on the Rambam, writes as follows: I believe the Rambam agrees that if a person accepts the seven Noahai laws on their own, we don't prevent them from living in the land. He only meant to say that the courts can't formally accept them, meaning he writes the Rambam agrees to the Ravid. I don't think he disagrees. The Rambam meant that too. Now, that is heavily disputed. If you've ever read a Rambam before, you know there are 50,000 opinions. That's an exaggeration, but there's many, many opinions for every single Rambam what he meant. And there are many commentators in the Rambam who disagree with the Kesef Mishnah, and they argue that no, the Rambam is saying we can no longer accept these people into the land of Israel today. So that is a matter of dispute. Based on this, and I have a summary here from Elazar Malambi, we have three different opinions as to this notion of Ger Toshav as it applies today in terms of living in the land of Israel. Opinion number one in source 11, that the prohibition of allowing foreigners is no longer applicable at all. Because it's like Charlie said, the first opinion is the prohibition of allowing foreigners in the land only applies to the seven Canaanite nation. Excuse the typo, it says apples, it's supposed to say applies. That's opinion one. So then it would no longer be applicable. However, we have opinion two. Opinion two is the prohibition of allowing foreigners in the land does not apply to all Gentiles who observe the seven Noahide laws. If you observe the seven Noahide laws, you're in. If not, you're out. And opinion three is we're stuck, because since we can no longer confer the status of Ger Toshav upon modern day Gentiles, we're in trouble. So does that solve our issue? Are we okay now that we had this discussion of Ger Toshav? How would we reconcile these laws with the modern Gentiles that live in Israel? Can we call them Ger Toshav? Can we rely on one of these opinions? Do they keep the seven Noahide laws? Complicated, right?
Rabbi, can I just ask one thing about the...
Yes, yeah.
Number seven in that list.
Yes.
It talked about rights of property. What does that really mean? That they're not allowed to have property?
No. Not quite the opposite. There's two ways to explain the last one. One of them is that generally they have to have courts to ensure right of property. And the other one is that they have to have monetary laws. They have to have monetary laws to ensure that people who own property get to keep it. It doesn't mean they don't have right of property. However, there's an issue here. There's a number of issues here, right? Let's think about this. Do all the Gentiles that live in Israel keep all seven Noahide laws?
Yeah, I think so. No, not the Muslims. So. I think okay. They should be kicked out. The ones that are interested in killing us.
Right. So your point, Leona, is the point that he makes here. He says as follows. And this is what he writes. This is Rav Elazar Malamed, who's an Israeli rabbi, writes as follows. Over the past decade, it's become clear that most members of the Druze community actually observe the seven commandments and recognize the right of the Jewish people to their land. Here, that's another condition which is not in the Rambam, but it does come from the Talmud as well. That in order to live in the land of Israel with the Jewish people, you have to recognize the right that we have the right to the land of Israel. If you say that we don't belong there, then you can't be a Ger Toshav, which makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? If you're saying you don't get to live here, then we're not going to let you live here. Like, it's sort of, you know, quid pro quo. So the Druze, he argues, do. We can say they're Ger Toshav, but what about everybody else? So here's where it gets complicated, okay? However, on the other hand, many of the Arabs living in the land of Israel do not accept the sovereignty of the people of Israel over their land, right? They don't think we have the right to Israel. They think we're a bunch of occupiers and invaders. They want us out. In addition, Many of them do not keep the seven commands of the sons of Noah. What do you mean? Aren't they very religious? Islam is a monotheistic religion, the Rambam says. But wait, there are seven mitzvot. Some by cooperating with terrorists who violate thou shalt not kill. That's one of the mitzvot. And some by not acting to prosecute them, as the seventh commandment commanded them to do. If you don't prosecute murderers, you're also violating the seven mitzvot. Now, we could have to go through all the different people and ask them, do you support terrorism? You don't. That gets sort of messy, doesn't it? Now I'll add, and here, and I know you're very curious about this, but these are long, long, extensive discussions. What about Christianity? So that is a very loaded question in terms of whether Christianity constitutes idolatry. And there are different opinions about it. Classically, certainly, most or almost all authorities agree that for a Jew to become a Christian and worship sort of Christianity as his practice would be a violation of idolatry for a Jew. The question of dispute is whether or not the doctrine of the Trinity, the Son, the Father, and the Holy Ghost constitutes idolatry. The majority opinion, I'm obviously summarizing a complex topic because I don't want this to be the focus of our discussion. The majority opinion for most of history was that that does constitute idolatry. There is a minority opinion associated with Moshe Isserles that maybe it's permissible for non-Jews to sort of partner another element with God and call that, you know, worshiping one God. You know, this is heavily disputed as to whether or not if they say they're worshiping one God, but they have different elements to that one God, if that constitutes idolatry for them. Very long, complicated discussion. So you have that notion also. Furthermore, what about the people who are atheists? What about the people who are, you know, what about people who worship many gods or the spirits? So they definitely don't fall under the rubric of keeping the seven Noahide laws. My point is that this is certainly an important route to take, but it's not sufficient. It's not sufficient for allowing the current state of Israel to function, because not every single resident of Israel is going to fulfill these seven Noahide laws. Now, what we do about that's a good question, but we certainly won't be able to countenance the Declaration of Independence simply by saying everybody's a Geritosha. That is not going to work. So we have to think of other alternatives, or consider other alternatives. One I'll mention very briefly is the Meiri. Rabbi Menachem Meiri, who I mentioned before, was a very important Rishon, commentator and rabbi of 13th century Provence. And the Meiri wrote a fascinating commentary. I actually gave a few shiurim on the Meiri earlier this year in a series I gave on the Jews of Provence. But one of the things that Meiri was very well known for and became a topic of great discussion in the modern era is his attitude toward religious tolerance generally. And we should appreciate the fact that this is not the majority opinion, and it was incredibly innovative at the time. But the Meiri has a lot of room for tolerance of Gentiles, who he describes as Gentiles who are governed by the dictates of religion. I brought for you two different examples here in your source sheet. I also gave you a link to an article by Professor Moshe Halbertal, who discusses this at length. The Meiri generally treats religious, quote-unquote, religious Gentiles like Jews in almost all halachot. For instance, if you look at source number 12, the first paragraph discusses the attitude toward idolaters, really Gentiles, in terms of monetary laws. And the Meiri writes, we cannot steal from anyone, you cannot steal from an idolater, and you cannot uproot the debt. So if you owe an idolater money, you can't avoid paying them back. However, we don't have an obligation to return their lost objects. Why? The Meiri argues, and it's interesting, he feels me justify this, that returning a lost object is actually quite a novelty. You could argue once somebody loses an object, it's no longer in their possession, and finding it is a sort of acquisition of that object. And we don't need to go above and beyond for people who worship idolatry. Returning a lost object is not just simple decency, it's piety, it's pious behavior. However, that's for normal idolaters. What I want to focus on is the next paragraph, which I'll read in Hebrew briefly. He says as follows, Kol shehu me'amim min, highlighted here, hagedurim bedarchei adat. Thus, all people who are of the nations are restricted by the ways of religion. Ve'odeh elokut al-ezet sad. And they serve God in some way. Afal pisha emunatam rechoka me'amunatenu. Even if their belief is far from ours. Eina bechlal zeh. They are not included in this rule of not being obligated to return their lost objects. Elahare heim ki Yisrael gamor. Lidvarim Elu. They are like complete Jews in this regard. So the Meiri argues that religious people, people who are restricted by the ways of religion and worship divinity, al eze sad in any way. And it's understood the Meiri is certainly referring to Christians, regardless of whether or not he thought that it was idolatry to worship the Trinity. He believed that they were governed by ways of religion generally. And the Meir writes this in many places. You have it again in Gideon. Mikol makom, umos agduo b'darchei adatot, those nations which are governed by the dictates of religion, umaminim b'mitziu toye barach, la'achduto v'yachoto, and believe in the oneness of God, afal pi shemishtabshin b'ktzat hadvarim, even though they mess up certain areas of faith, l'fi amanutenu, according to our belief, Ein lahem makom bidvarim elu. They are not relevant to these certain restrictions on idolaters. So if we do hold like the Meiri, who has a much more progressive view on religious tolerance, there's a lot that's been written about this Meiri. Did it really mean it? Was it because of the censors? And why does he say this? Is this an expansion of Gerut Toshav? Is it more than that? Is it specifically Christians? Is it everyone? The point being, this, if we accepted the Meiri head on, would allow a greater allowance beyond just Ger Toshav. It certainly would seem to allow tolerance for Christians and Muslims, at least the ones who are peaceful, and the Jews, and all those who are governed by the restrictions of religion and monotheism generally. However, I think it's hard to suggest that this would apply to people who are completely secular. Right? Now, the question is the Meiri point that they're civilized, that they're not a bunch of barbarians, or is his point that they believe in God? In these two sources, it certainly seems like he at least requires belief in one divine figure. So that also doesn't completely allow us to halachically adopt the Declaration of Independence. So there, here we get to some more considerations. So one consideration is a simple question. What is the alternative? What do you want us to do? Do you want us to go and chase out all the people that don't believe in one God to rid the land of idolatry? That ain't gonna work so well. Now, that's not just a pragmatic concern, even though it is certainly a pragmatic concern, because we have to worry about things like diplomacy and international relations. It's also a halachic concern, because if you look back in the Rambam had a very important phrase when he talked about our obligations. I'll scroll back to it here. He says, this is all applies when Yad Yisrael takifa aleihem. The hand of Israel is dominant upon them. What does that mean? And does that apply nowadays? And many modern poskim argue, no, it does not apply nowadays. We don't have Yad Tekifa. Even though we have an independent nation, we are a sovereign nation to some degree, we still don't have the same status the Rambam is referring to. Rabbi Isaac Alevi Herzog, one of the chief rabbis of Israel after its founding, argues that it's absurd to think that we actually have to go about kicking everybody out. Simply because they worship idolatry, even per se. Because he says, I'll just read in English, what should we do? To say to nations, the other, the nations that allowed us to have a state, We cannot accept this condition because our Torah forbids a Jewish government to allow settlement in our country for Christians and pagans. Is that what he wants to say? And in addition, it forbids us to allow their worship in our country and forbids us to allow them purchase land. I do not think there will be a rabbi in Israel with a mind and a common sense who thinks that we must respond in this way, meaning that it is our duty from the law of our Holy Torah. No one thinks that. We actually have to go and say, you know what, United Nations, and let me clarify, he's writing this immediately before the state is founded. He's writing this as the United Nations is about to adopt in 1948, the notion of giving the Jewish people sovereignty in the land of Israel. And he thinks, well, you want to tell them, hey, sorry, no can do. We can't accept freedom of religion. Sorry, it's against our Torah. And the reason is because we don't have Yad Tekifa. We don't have that right. Now, Rav Shaul Yisraeli argues in Torah 15, another very prominent Israeli posek, Israeli halakhic decisor, that it doesn't just mean that if we say no, we're all going to die. That's not the point. Because you could argue, is it really true? You know, could we push it a little bit? Is it really true that we'd all die if we started bashing places of idolatry? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Rav Shaul Yisraeli says that's not what it means. It doesn't mean that. He says as follows. Harei kfar pasak haRambam she'eino Yisrael she'yashivat akam medina ela kashayad Yisrael tkifa. The Rambam rules that this the prohibition against allowing idolaters to live in the state is only when the hand of Israel is dominant. What does that mean, the hand of Israel is dominant? Pirush HaDvarim she'ein hayad tkifa hu. Akarach halom mishum zakanam nefashot. It doesn't mean that we're going to put all our lives at risk if we follow through on these commandments. That's not what it means. Hizehu davar she'ein tzorach lomar. That's obvious. It's obvious we don't have to all die to ensure that there's no idolatry in Israel. That can't be what it means. It's more than that. It means that we have to act in this way and allow this freedom in order to maintain normal relations with the surrounding nations and to prevent the nations and prevent and not allow them to have an opening to slander the Jews in our land. Therefore, he argues, look, regardless of whether or not it would be an immediate danger, if the Jewish state started expelling anyone on account of their religion, that would be universally condemned by everyone. So that's point one. We don't have Yad Tekifa L'Alamot, which is necessary in order to be obligated in these mitzvot of expelling those who do not keep Seshem Mitzvot Bnei Noach. Isaac Levy Herzog, in this article, goes beyond that, though, and he makes a few more arguments I think are worth considering, briefly as we run out of time. One is as follows. What kind of obligation is it to rid Israel of idolatry? That's not an obligation upon you or me or any of us in this Zoom chat right now. No, that is a national obligation. Says Rabbi Isaac Levy Herzog, national obligations have a certain context. Obligations have context. He says it's clear and evident that national obligation only exists when we come to sovereignty on our own, when we are not beholden to other nations for our state. In such a case, and he says, when we hearken back to the times of King Solomon and King David, that's when this mitzvah applies. That's the necessary background. But it wouldn't apply in our day. Furthermore, he argues that the whole formation of the state is based upon a certain partnership. We shouldn't view this as it's the Jews in charge who are sovereign. It's true that we have the most control over the land of Israel. However, the land of Israel was given to us as sort of a partnership with the other nations of the world, with the understanding that we would abide by certain considerations. So we can't simply reject that partnership. In such a context, it doesn't make sense to go about violating our own Declaration of Independence and violating international law, because we don't have that full sovereignty. And I'll also argue that another point makes, which I think is actually a very good one, we have to consider our options. And one of the options to consider is what is going to bring about the least of influence, negative influence in assimilation. We can either have a state given to us and are allowed to us by some of the other nations of the world, which includes freedom of religion and democracy, or we could have no state. I guarantee you there'll be more assimilation if the state of Israel can function at all. So we have to take our options. Ultimately, right now, in order to strengthen Jewish belief, it's more important, and 1947 writes Rav Herzog, to make sure we get the state and that we can have some sort of autonomy and bolster Judaism and Jewish practice and Jewish beliefs, rather than saying, you know what? No, we don't want this unless you're going to allow us to do exactly what we want. That ultimately will compromise things more. So this sort of perspective is sort of saying, if we go beyond Geri Toshav and the Meiri, it's essentially saying, look, this might be on the books an obligation, but practically it's not relevant. Not relevant because you don't have the power, not relevant because we're sort of bound by the laws that we accepted upon ourselves when the state was established. You could even argue, as I read from Rav Chaim Jachter in Gray Matter, he quotes Rav Amital from Yehuda Amital from Har Etzion, who writes that when we accepted the Declaration of Independence, that itself was binding. We can't violate as a nation our own Declaration of Independence. Furthermore, in Surah 17, Elazar Malamed has a really interesting argument. He says, think about the effect of respect for minorities on the world. Yetzer al Kain, moreover, Dor Dachronim, Bischosh Hashbatam Musrit Shal Torah Yisrael, because of the moral influence of the Torah Yisrael, our Torah, Zachinu V'mat Alon Kiblu Atzman Chukim Shashomrim Masliutayim Shal Miutim. Other nations of the world now today have adopted the laws that protect the rights of minorities. V'mnechil Hashem, Asor Lanu Gereish Da'aravim She'nam B'gari Gertoshav. In order to avoid the desecration of the divine name, we can't simply expel those Arabs who are not Geri Tosha. Shekin klal hachatihu shelo yitachein shiyeh davar asur l'noah or Yisrael yeh mutar. Really interesting idea. It's a general law that there can't be the Noahide laws, or the laws for Gentiles cannot be more strict than the laws for the Jews. So if other nations of the world have adopted a law in which they don't expel people who they disagree with religiously, it doesn't make sense for the Jewish nation to not have those standards. The Imalpia dinim sha mutukanim sha bumoto lon kavu, asor lagares bune ochlo sayim yud gan kishin uyonim, gam Yisrael tzarech lach hashov midat ha'shar mit anda misir enzim. If the national law, international law, says you can't kick people out who you disagree with, even strongly, we also need to abide by these laws. However, and I'll leave you with this, two more points. He argues as follows. That being said, we have to figure out the most appropriate way to proceed, given the confines. So he has a pretty provocative argument. He says that what we need to do is establish a socioeconomic policy that will encourage peaceful migration of those who do not identify with the values of Jewish people. Meaning he's arguing, and again, this is his idea. He's certainly, you know, not the most moderate, that we should try to find ways to have them peacefully, those who cannot be classified as Geri Toshav because they don't keep the seven mitzvot or they don't accept Jewish sovereignty. We should try another way to have them no longer live in the land of Israel. But I want to emphasize the last thing he says here. In the meantime, when in practice no deportation can be made to those who are not entitled to be considered a resident Geri Toshav, the basic mitzvah returns to treat all human beings with respect and love. For the tendency of the mitzvah is to establish a society that is entirely a partner in the ideal of the Torah, and not for the purpose of hating foreigners and harming them. Therefore, when for various reasons the mitzvah cannot be kept, or can be kept to a limited extent by encouraging immigration. The basic mitzvah to treat with respect and love any person whose positions are not known to be evil or who is not hostile to us remains in place. Malami makes a very important point here, that if practically we can't fulfill this, then the general obligation to treat everyone with love and respect who's not hostile towards our nation returns. And that even if someone isn't keeping Shem Mitzvah Bnei Noach, does not give you the right to ridicule them or to discriminate against them. Because now that they're here, then they're here. And we have to have respect. And finally, I'll leave you with Rav Rabinovich. Rav Rabinovich, who passed away just a year or so ago, was a very, very well-known thinker, just writes the following. It's actually in the context of accepting donations from the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, a Christian organization. And there's a concern about accepting such donations, but he writes as follows. Our generation has been blessed with a unique blessing many generations have yearned for, to see the actualization of the God's promise of Israel's return to its land. This opportunity gives us the responsibility to meet the challenge of fulfilling the historical destiny of the nation of Israel, and you shall be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. In every era, new thinking is required to determine how to actualize historical destiny. That we have to think about the best way to be a Mamlecha Kohanim, a kingdom of priests, an Orla Gayim nowadays. And if for certain reasons, the best way to do that now is to allow people who we vehemently disagree with to live among us so that we can most appropriately fulfill our job as Mamlecha Kohanim, then that's what we need to do. So I know I'm over time. Essentially, it's a very complicated issue. There's no easy solutions here. There's nothing, there's no snap of the fingers, okay, and now the problems are going to go away. But I think there is a clash between the ideal and the real, that there's a recognition that certain laws in the Torah, which might apply in a situation in which we had this kingdom of David and Shlomo, where we had full sovereignty, may no longer apply because of the constraints that we live in. And we should recognize that. That being said, and Chaim points out the ISJ was created by an incredibly run of Orthodox Jews. That very possibly, but I think the general the concern is when Christian organizations donate to the land of Israel. Can we accept those? But I think that's what we're grappling with. We're grappling with how to take the mission of the state of Israel, of a nation founded based upon Jewish values and ideals, and actualizing that in the real world around us. That is the mission of religious Zionism, and it's something that we have to continue to grapple with and think about today. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining. And I